draconian.
Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Reyes, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
Good morning, you may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals for November 16. And as counsel was aware, I think there was correspondence from appellant's counsel to recommend switching, but we declined that pursuant to the rules. But certainly, if because of that, appellant's counsel feels there's not much to say, you don't need to use the entire 15 minutes if you do not wish to, but otherwise we'll follow our normal protocol. We do ask that counsel identify themselves for the record before you begin, and the middle podium, should you choose to use that one, does have the advantage of both going up and down, and it's got the timer on it, so it's a little easier to access. And I'll just note for the record this first matter, A220993, Marguerite Rosemary Descut. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Descut.
Descut. The T is silent?
I guess so.
Okay, thank you. Versus Ralph Patterson, Descut, and the respondent, but the appellant is Gregory J. Is it Hudala?
Hudala.
Hudala, very good, thank you. And the parties are ready. Counsel for appellant, you may approach the podium, identify yourself, and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. James Martin, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Hudala. And as the court now knows, the issue that Hudala has raised on appeal, i.e., that the statute 518.14 did not permit imposition of personal liability is an issue now that apparently is conceded on this other end of this case. So I won't talk about Sandvik at all, and I'll move forward to in an attempt to anticipate briefly the arguments that will be made by counsel for Mr. Descut. And it comes down to this. Did the trial court abuse its discretion in denying the motion to amend the December 9th, January 2nd findings and conclusions of law? And that's a pretty challenging standard to show an abuse of discretion. We don't think it can be proven here, and I've got about seven reasons to support my argument that there was no abuse of discretion on the court's part in denying the motion to amend. And they're in the brief mostly, so pardon me if I'm a little bit repetitious here, and I'm not going to use the 15 minutes, but I've got about seven reasons to suggest that Judge or Referee Snow, with her order confirmed by the district court, did not abuse the discretion, and it was appropriate for her to deny the motion to amend. First, the proposal for the amended findings and conclusions was really just an amended conclusion of law without any suggestion from Mr. Descut that the trial court should make findings to suggest bad faith conduct on Mr. Hudala's part or vexatious, harassing conduct that would otherwise be something that you'd see in a 549.21 sanction. Second reason that there's been no abuse is that clearly Mr. Descut did not comply with the safe harbor provisions. The motion for sanctions was combined with their opposition motion to dismiss Mr. Hudala, his client's claims altogether, were not separately made. The 21-day rule was ignored. The motion was served on November 16th for a hearing on the 23rd. Hudala was essentially caught flat-footed in no position once the issue was being made of misconduct to throw his client under the bus and say that, well, I only was relying on what she was telling me about the non-receipt of the benefits from the plans.
Counsel?
Yes.
I think that everyone agrees that the statute doesn't allow the imposition of attorney fees. I think that the respondent's argument today is that we should just sit in this position of the district court.
That's
and make a decision about fees. Putting that question aside, assuming that we remand the case to the district court, is there anything that prevents the district court from reconsidering the motion for fees under 549.21, Rule 11, or some other request?
Judge Frisch, I think that would be a repetition of what's already been attempted here. Mr. DeCou went to the district court and said, hey, you screwed up. We need you to say that it is a violation of 549.21. And the district court was fully aware of the Swenick decision. And as I referred to it in my brief, it was the elephant in the room. And that was what was motivating the motion to amend. So Judge Referee Snow, and then the judge that signed off on the order, was aware of the implications and consequences of denying that motion. But it's been presented once already, and I would hope that this court would not be remanding and instructing that somehow the issue should be revisited. I think it's been revisited on the merits, and it was denied. And that's clear, if I may add, from Judge Snow's finding number 7. She was very much aware of the fact that the requirements for sanctions under Rule 11 or 549, whichever, I think we've conceded they're about the same, were not complied with here. She said, hey, there was no separate motion made. And in addition, there was no reference ever in any of the papers submitted by Mr. DeCou, either at the time of the November 23rd hearing or later on in May, suggesting that there was bad faith conduct or other conduct. In fact, 549 is customarily often used when the claim is that the conduct was intending to delay the proceedings, and that's the last thing that Hudala had on his mind. He was trying to advance it. There was no intent here to delay or harass. So the fourth reason, if I've answered your question.
You have. Thank you.
Third reason is that 549.21, Rule 11, contemplate a violation of the lawyer's certification that there is good faith belief that these claims are legitimate or these defenses are legitimate. The one and only time that Hudala submitted a paper or a pleading to the court in which some pretty nasty stuff may, by somebody's lights, have been present was October the 13th when he filed the motion to enforce the terms of the J&D and alleged intemperately, I'll say, inappropriately, I'll say, this wasn't the way it was done back in the day when I was doing more of this. But that motion was only made as of October the 13th, and 549 is addressing the inappropriateness of a pleading that was asserted without a good faith basis to believe there was some support for it. And when, in fact, a month later, he gets the document that says, hey, everything's cool here. The lawyers that were handling the case for the parties 20 years ago, there it is. And he says, my gosh, my client was wrong. She did get everything she was supposed to get. And so I'm withdrawing the motion. This case is over with. And it's been argued or suggested in the opposition brief here that he didn't withdraw the motions. We've cited to the record clearly, Hudala said, everything's moot. This exhibit, 18 is the addendum number, puts an end to it. So the purpose of 549 is deterrence, not punishment. Well, without a proper notification, without the 21-day notice, Mr. Hudala on his own withdrew the claim. That is one reason why the district court could have said, well, why would we be now imposing a sanction? The fellow withdrew it voluntarily and didn't even have a Rule 11 notification. They've made much of the August 31st letter that was sent by counsel to Hudala saying, these claims are groundless and we intend to seek sanctions if you pursue them. That there was no pleading to withdraw at that time. There was no certification by that time by the lawyer that says there's a good faith belief. That only happened as of October 13th, and if he'd have been given the proper notice, then we wouldn't be here today. So the sixth reason is that there is no abuse of discretion here. In fact, that the trial court would have been committing an abuse if the grant, the motion had been granted, is the fact that the June 29th order denying the motion to amend demonstrates that Referee Snow carefully looked at the prior orders, carefully considered the merits, and after having done that says, I'm not going to change anything. So those are the reasons why I respectfully submit that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in denying the motion to amend. We ask that this court vacate the judgment entered against Mr. Hudala and affirm the ruling of the trial court denying the motion to amend. If there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'll sit down. All right.
Very good. Very well. Thank you, counsel. Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and then proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Susan Gallagher, and I represent the respondent, Ralph Descoux, in this matter. To say that this has been a frustrating case is probably an understatement, certainly for my client and for myself. In July of 2021, in his letter, Appellant Hudala advanced his specious claim of fraud, claiming that my client had not cooperated, claiming that my client had not paid retirement funds, and claiming that my client was going to owe Ms. Rafferty, formerly Ms. Descoux, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So as we proceeded in this case, providing him with authorizations and giving him as much information as we could, giving him direction to look at MNSIS, which showed Index 19 and 20 as quadro orders, giving him direction about how to get those quadro orders, giving him other information about what he could do to proceed to obtain information, and he ignored those, instead proceeded in filing his motion, both first for a motion to compel and for a motion for sanctions. And his claim was that my client had converted funds and had committed fraud on the court and should be sanctioned. So we proceeded in this case in my response, and you'll note that I did not ask for 518.14 fees, and I did not ask for 549.211 fees. My motion was to ask for conduct-based fees. At no time in any submissions that I have made have I asked for 518.14 or 549.211.
You know, I appreciate that, counsel. I'm just, the concern I have, speaking for myself and not my colleagues, is you're asking us today to stand in the shoes of the district court and make rulings as to the appropriateness of a Rule 11 sanction, and I'm just not aware of any authority that allows us to do that. Is there some authority that allows the appellate court to undertake that?
I believe there is, Your Honor. I think the district court has the inherent power to sanction.
That's the district court, right?
Yes.
But not us.
Well, this court can remand to the district court for sanctions consistent with the underlying order. I believe that you can. And it was clear that Judge Conley, the trial court judge who heard this matter, wanted to sanction Mr. Hudala, who saw that his behavior was inappropriate and called it, you know, the advancement of fraud and making a false claim because he had failed to investigate this matter. And under Uselman, a frivolous or baseless claim that is not investigated is in bad faith. It's res ipsa in bad faith. So I don't think you have to say that. I mean, if the court believes that the district court must say the words bad faith, then of course we're done, right? But if the court said that he failed to investigate his claim and advanced a claim of fraud inappropriately and in bad faith, that is enough. That is enough. So I think in this case, we've been stuck, in my opinion, in a procedural box. I agree 518.14 doesn't apply. I'm not sure that I initially believed that when I was starting this case and when we got the ruling in this case, but I certainly have come to understand that and believe that. I also believe that I didn't advance a claim for Rule 11 sanctions under 549.211, but there are procedural requirements specific to that. But the inherent powers that are recognized at the district court level don't require that you specifically follow the rules of Rule 11. It requires notice and an opportunity to respond. So the opportunity to respond, the notice was, certainly I gave him notice in letters, and mostly I think trial courts honor that I've given you notice in a letter that I'm doing something or I'm asking for something or I'm telling you something, but certainly in my motion of 11-16-21, I asked for fees, and I asked for fees relative to this advancement of this claim of fraud inappropriately. And he responded in great detail the next day on November 17th with talking about exactly what he had done and what he had tried to do and what he understood and that the whole detailed picture that he had done in great detail. I don't know if he didn't ask for more time to respond. So he was heard then, the court heard us on the 23rd of November. During that hearing, he didn't ask for, Your Honor, I'd like to be able to respond further to this. Could we have another hearing on this? He didn't exercise any opportunity that he might have had.
Is it your view that the matter is fully, that the record is fully developed before the district court to make a decision about the imposition of sanctions? Or is there something else that your client is looking to supplement the record with?
I don't know that I would supplement the record, Your Honor. I think there are things like, I can tell you, in my opinion, I could have said things like, if Mr. Hudal had appropriately investigated this matter, if I was him, and I was not going to advance fees on my client's behalf to investigate what we knew had happened, I would have filed a subpoena or served a subpoena on Ms. Rafferty's retirement account. And I would have gotten the information, right? That's where it would have been. It would have been done. I would have pulled those quadros, and I would have said, oh, these quadros were approved by the court. What happened here? Why aren't they done? So I think some of that information was clearly before Mr. Hudala. I gave him some of that information in my August 30th letter. So I don't think it's my job to direct him how he needs to investigate. I think it's his job as an attorney to investigate, and if he doesn't know how to reach out to somebody that has more skills than he does to do this.
Counsel, if we were to reverse and remand and allow the district court to consider Rule 11 sanctions, when it sounds like you're saying that issue had already been presented to the district court, isn't it just giving your client a second bite at the apple? When the district court never relied on that for its decision, it seems a little inequitable to allow. Okay, well, district court, let's here's a second chance to find another reason to sanction.
Well, I don't think there's any preclusion from bringing a 549.211 motion subsequent to this hearing. I don't know that I think it's the best practice. I don't think it's ideal. I don't know that I intend to do it, but I think the problem that, and maybe it's just the equities, and I appreciate that you understand the equities, is that my client incurred, $16,000 in fees because of what Mr. Hudala failed to do and his client failed to do. And so because of the order of the court under 518.14, Mr. Hudala gets to escape and my client gets to incur the fees. And I think that's not an equitable solution. And I'm not up here arguing the equities. I think the only escape from the procedural box that I see is that this court can say that there's inherent powers of the court to sanction, and the court exercised those inherent powers by finding that Mr. Hudala, in bad faith, failed to investigate and advanced a specious claim of fraud. And so I think that's where we're I think that's where the very narrow issue is. I think the equities are horrible. It's very, I think that's the frustrating part here is that, you know, here
can
we are.
Can I just ask Ms. Geller, isn't that often the case that in a 518-14 conduct-based fees scenario that it would be impossible, I assume, much of the time for the court to differentiate between the conduct specifically of the party versus the attorney for the party, or if they're sometime blending together. But the important part of the finding is that, nevertheless, it extended the proceedings such that it incurred your client, the requesting party, incurred costs. So the point being here, that's always the case, and if the court simply would have ordered 100% of it, we'd be done. We wouldn't be here, I presume.
It's true. So it's
what
true.
Would be, but the court didn't, and, of course, we just have the very narrow issue is can the court, and everybody agrees, cannot. So I wonder on what basis we would have to remand when the alternative method, as you pointed out, was presented to the court, and implicitly at least, there was no other basis to do it, and the court just used 518.14 and divvied it up 80 to 20.
So I'm not even convinced that the court used 518.14 in that regard. I think at the time the court was very busy in transitioning off of family court, and I think maybe it was a little bit more quickly done than in my opinion. And I think Judge Conley is a fabulous judge, so I have nothing to say adverse about him at all. He is great. But and certainly the court could have said, Ms. Rafferty, you're going to pay the whole thing. You're going to pay the $16,000. And I think, again, that's, you know, and I don't know that the court got into the argument about it being an equitable situation, but Mr. Hirala, is, according to the court, is the one that's learned in the law and should have known how to proceed with this. She didn't offer any reason why she hadn't gotten her retirement funds or claimed that she hadn't gotten her retirement funds more than 20 years after the fact, why she didn't remember different things. And trust me, I'm old enough now, we're not going to go into how why you might not remember every detail about everything. But I think I think the court saw the inequities of ordering Ms. Hirala to pay all those fees. And I appreciate that. I think that that's often there's attorneys that make horrible mistakes and they have clients that are, you know, unaware and, of course, under a malpractice claim. They're not going to be able to bring a malpractice claim. So I think the court's trying to address the inequities. And some of that's my personal thought about it. I guess I don't have any record to support that, but I believe that's what the judge was trying to do. And he did make a statement that Mr. Hirala is the one that's learned it in the law and should have known better in doing it. So if we fail here, we fail here, Your Honor. I think the court has the power to remand to order the district court to make a finding that that this is the inherent power of the trial court to have ordered this. I also believe that I want to address a very narrow issue on the motion for amended findings in that the district court found that the December 9th order was the order that we should have appealed. That was not a final order under Min Rule Civ App Pro 10303, which has got to be the defining thing about whether this is a final order. The December 3rd order was the only order ordering the apportionment of fees and ordering me to provide the court with the detail. That was certainly not the final order. The order, final order, I believe, was the April 13th, 2022 order that said, you know, let judgment be entered accordingly, and that's the final order from which a motion for amended findings can occur, and I think that's where the district court erred. So, thank you.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you may have up to 5 minutes rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you. And I'm glad that there's 5 minutes because I forgot to mention inherent authority as the issue that they've raised. And just 2 points. Those words were never submitted to the court in any brief or in oral argument. You should find, using your inherent authority, that the sanction should be imposed. And so I don't think that's an issue that's even properly before the court. It wasn't a theory that was advanced in the lower court and shouldn't be allowed here. But apart from that, there was, and I think counsel's own brief agrees, that unless there is a finding of bad faith, you cannot, as the court, inherent authority, impose sanctions. That's the United States Supreme Court case that's cited in our briefs, both of them, and in the Minnesota case law. So absent of finding a bad faith, which they all but asked the trial court to make, and the trial court said no, nix on tricks. We, you know, silence on that issue is the equivalent of denial. It was just suggested that counsel didn't ask for any kind of relief at the time of the November 23rd hearing. I say page 8 from the transcript. It's in the record. So, Your Honor, I really don't know how to proceed from here. We're on a motion to compel. While the underlying issue of all the motions have been resolved as far as attorney's fees go, if we want to set up a hearing in the future for the good faith basis for my client's claims, and my client will be happy to present it. And it never went beyond that. And in just a matter of several days, the court had issued the order that imposed the sanction. Incidentally, when counsel submitted then the proposed amount for to be awarded, the court signed off on the proposal on the very day that it was received, and counsel Hudala had no opportunity, not that it is real significant. I don't know if he'd have been able to show that it was too much, but this is just the way it was handled. So when we talk about equities here, Hudala, if anything, you know, this is a Don Quixote. This is a quixotic attempts to, he's riding the steed in order to get his client some money. She's needing all of this in order to survive. He's the guy on the steed. And he gets information in June, early July, from Fidelity, not Hewlett-Packard, Fidelity. And the information that he gets suggests that, hey, this guy's already rolled over. He's got all of the distribution. She says, well, I don't remember getting any of that. And it's only 2.5, 3 months later when Hudala, using a subpoena, said to Hewlett-Packard, hey, what's going on here? And Hewlett-Packard shows the records that indicate, no, everything was cool, everything was kosher, it was done correctly. And then upon receipt of that, he said, okay, two of the three outstanding plan disputes, I agree now, she's been paid. She's got no complaint. The only remaining one had to do with the so-called 401k plan and with the receipt and his of the letter between the lawyers back in April 2001 that removed any further doubt. So the notion here is that Hudala was guilty of flagrant, vexatious, harassing, bad faith conduct, and it's just not there in the record. I don't want to get into the weeds on factual findings, but Judge Snow had everything in front of her, and she decided, no, I'm not going to say that this is a 549 situation. I'm not going to mess with what Judge Connolly did. I've looked at it, and it's clear that he thought something should have been done about this, but I can't change, and I'm not going to change anything further. I'm racing through. I just got the complaint here. This guy was overzealous. I'll grant that, you know, in pursuit of his client's interests. But in the end, it was all about what triggered all of this was his motion to compel discovery. And that is, and whether he was overdoing it, ignoring what he was getting, according to the rules, Rule 11 and 549, sanctions are not applicable as to disputes involving discovery. So I didn't mention that before. I just want to get it out there for you. It's in my brief. There's lots of other things I wanted to comment, but I can't remember, so I'll sit down. Thank you very much.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing and your answers to the questions we did have. We will be taking the matter under advisement, issue a ruling within 90 days. So you each have a good day.